Black Reel 12. How long were you on the Turi Haku around then?
Only a matter really of a few days, and then the breakout into Belgium occurred, and it was really rapid. I mean, you lost touch with everyone apart from your own troop. You knew you were going forward, the troop was going forward, the regiment was going forward, batteries were going forward. You got mixed up with all sorts of columns of tanks and infantry, but everyone was on the move forward very, very rapidly. I don't know what the rate of advance was. I wouldn't like to say, but I think somebody 20-odd miles a day or something like that. Very soon we were up in Louviers.
Did you go through the Falaise trap?
Oh yes, we went through the Falaise gap there.
What were the scenes like?
Oh, the scenes there were horrific. When we passed through there, I mean, it was just a mass of German burnt out vehicles. Again, the dead cows, shattered farmhouses, shell holes. The stench, the German killed were lying there. We saw our first German wounded being brought back in through the lines after they closed the gap, they trapped so many in there, and it was just It beats description, really. You can't describe this. It was horrible, really, to see this mass destruction and killing. And,
was this the first time you'd seen Germans actually face to face?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You'd be curious about them, did you?
Well, I mean, at times we just brought them through. In our case, we had to bring them through, process them, and send them back. We didn't have really time for the talk. Then we weren't allowed to interrogate anything like that. It was merely we collected them and.
What condition were they in?
Some of them quite reasonable. I mean, the Germans certainly never were a ragtag army. I mean, they were a bit like ourselves. They were disciplined and always trying to be fairly smart. There was some of them that obviously. Been sort of conscripts. They weren't terribly enthusiastic, but in the main, and of course, quite a few of them quite arrogant, even when they'd been captured.
And you're moving forward at quite a pace.
Yes.
And obviously coming across French people and villages that.
We passed through, when we passed through Falaise, we're quickly really into Belgium, because Louviers is just out on the border. And the reception we got there was certainly quite a change from what we'd had received in France. I mean, the people were ecstatic. I mean, we weren't the first ones through, we were probably about a day behind the infantry, but still the enthusiasm was there, the gifts of what they could give, the flowers and then jumping on your vehicle. And I remember we were going up the road just short of Louviers, and there was a little, we were called a little pub along the roadside, went in there and, beer if you wanted, and wine. You could have anything they had. I liked the Belgian people.
And you say the French weren't quite as good. Even the Northern French, who'd been in two world wars, in effect, yeah. Were they not different in their attitude towards you? More friendly with being...
Well, once we left the sort of staging area on the beaches where we'd first come across, we didn't have a lot of contact with the French people. I mean, we were moving from sort of position to position, and they had more or less been evacuated because of all the heavy fighting. There was the odd farmhouse with the farmer and his family probably had stayed, but they weren't bad. I mean, in one particular case, when we had the gun on the site, they did come out with at night time when we're on sort of watch with drinks of hot milk for us. And It's like any country, I think. You get people who care and people who don't.
And you saw no action, no attempts to attack you on this long journey through France into Belgium.
No, the only thing we saw was the columns of German prisoners being escorted back to the rear.
Did you ever see anything of the French freedom fighters, the FFI?
Just a little of them. What we did see was the collaborators being dealt with, their heads being shaven, and that's which, I mean, that's, I don't know. For all I know, they collaborated in one thing or another, but to see a woman being dragged, literally dragged by her hair, and then her hair all cut off, it didn't gel with any of us. I mean, I don't think. I mean, okay, they should have been taken in and dealt with, but I think that sort of, lynch mob justice doesn't work anywhere.
And you didn't like it, as you were saying.
Oh no, no, no. We couldn't stop it, of course. We didn't step in, and we could have done if we'd wanted to. We had the force to do it, but we wouldn't. I mean, it was a civilian thing. And when we got towards Belgium, the attitude did change quite a lot. Well, what we did pick up in the Falaise Gap was when we moved through was a vast assortment of vehicles. I think just about everybody had a car or van or something like that. It was a real hodgepodge of German vehicles, and the likes of caravans for company officers and mobile cookhouses. We had the mobile cookhouse that we named it Maisie Doats. That was the song that was going around at the time, Maisie Doats and Dozy Doats and Little Lamsy Dizy. And that was towed on the back of a three-tonner. Stayed with us quite a long way.
We're picking German weapons up.
Oh yes, there's quite a lot of German weapons.
They tended to be particularly good weapons, didn't they?
Oh yes, yes, they were good. There was nothing. The Smeisers and these sort of things were much superior to our Sten guns did the job, but they were a Woolworths gun, really.
So after you got into Belgium, then what happened to you?
Well, we moved quickly through Louviers towards Rouen, which I mean was an inland port, and there's quite a lot of activity there.
Still in France at this time,
yes,
of course,
yes, yes, at that particular time, and then we moved on to Brussels. We were very quickly into Brussels. We stayed in Brussels for quite some time, in fact, over Christmas. And the only alarm we had there was when the Germans were making their counterattack through the Ardennes, and we were in Brussels, which was fairly close, and we were put in standby for to go down and help the Americans, who, as you know, bore the brunt of that. That action, but before we could move, the weather cleared and the Air Force cleared things up for us, fortunately.
What was life like in Brussels?
Oh, it was marvellous. you wouldn't have thought there'd been a war on. I mean, the shops were, seemed to be fully stocked with everything. I was even managed to get a few pair of silk stockings, in the shops to send home. The big stores, I remember, and particularly there's a store named after it here now, Von Marsh. They were open and thriving. The cafes at night time were fairly active. So that we did. I mean, it was the one. It was a relaxing moment when we went there. We were based actually on the outside of Brussels, but I did manage a 48-hour leave into Brussels. Most of us got you always got a leave when they could.
And where did you stay? For the
we stayed in the in an army hostel, actually. The army had taken it over for a leave hostel. Eventually, the next time we were there, the NAFI had taken over buildings, and they had hostels there. And the YMCA as well, of course, were moving in.
Now, city would be quite full of troops, I presume.
Oh yes, Brussels was quite full of troops. Yes.
And the Belgian people or Brussels people, were they?
Oh, they were excellent. Yes. Yeah.
Ladies would be available, of course.
Oh, they were. If you're that way inclined, but just having been just married, you thought twice. Oh, you were pulled up in the streets for the. And they weren't shy in coming forward. I mean, I've seen them in their estaminets where they sort of grab one of the chaps' hats and whip it away upstairs, and you had to chase it. And of course, you know what happened once they got up there.
Was VD a problem in the unit? Did you have men that went down with it?
We didn't have a case of VD all the time. There was these prophylactic stations that supplied the necessary. I mean, if I thought, well, if I've got to go through that rigmarole, I'm not bothered. I mean, creams and all sorts of things, and also, if you had been with anyone, you're supposed to report back to them. And one or two of our fellas had, and they said, oh, I'm not going through that again. What they did to them. I mean, they literally injected them with...
Were you warned as a general thing?
We had warnings right through our army service. I mean, even in this country, we weren't warned. In fact, they took such a strong view of it that you were told in the early days that if you contracted VD, your army allowance would stop. And then, of course, if people at home would want to know why it stopped. And I think that it would put a lot of people off. I mean, it wasn't a savage put, but I mean, the warning was there. And of course, you were warned about the effect of it. And I think you're a fool if you knew about these things and you just went into it lightly.
And it was presumably an offence to get VD.
It was. In the army, it was an offence. But so mind, that didn't prevent them, because we had some people that had sort of drafted into us that would be in the regular. I mean, they used to boast about how many times they'd had it. And
so you were in Brussels, you say, quite a while.
Yes.
Now, where did you move to then?
Well, from there, we began to move up to through Holland. This was going to be a build-up to, what was it, Operation Orchard, wasn't it, the drop at Arnhem. We were instructed to go with the 4th Guards Armoured Division and the 15th, I think it was the 15th Scottish. We moved forward to the bridges at, first of all, well, we moved to Borge Leopold first, and we lagered up there for 2 or 3 days. And then we began to sort of advance into the bridges at, first of all, at Eindhoven. That was the first bridge. That was intact when we got there. They'd taken it intact, but we put a protective covering on the bridge until the main forces got through. And then progressively we moved up from Eindhoven to Graves. Graves was a little bit different. There had been quite a fight around there, and there was quite a lot of American gliders down there. In fact, the last of the American gliders came in just as we reached the bridge. Again, the bridge was undamaged, so we managed to get the troops got across okay. We used to, when we got to the bridges, until most of the troops got through, we had what they called bridge umbrella, and that all the guns in the regiment, the whole 54 of them, were stationed round the bridge. And if there was any sign of any aircraft approaching for to bomb the bridge, you just didn't have to identify a target. if a plane came over, a German plane came over, you just let blaze. And of course, it was a concentrated fire above the bridge. And I don't think they would ever got through. We only did, I think we only did that once in Ireland. We did it a lot more in Nijmegen, which I'm coming on to. When we got to Nijmegen, the road bridge had been destroyed, but the rail bridge was still there and it had road access. And we were stationed, again, stationed round there. But there had been quite a lot of heavy fighting round Nijmegen. We were billeted in Nijmegen for a while, because then the advance literally was held up, because there's only a single road out of Nijmegen, usable road, to Arnhem. And the whole idea was that we were to go up to Arnhem for to join up with the airborne. But of course it never happened, because they just could not get up that road. I mean, the Tiger tanks were knocking off the lorries left, right and centre as they attempted to go up there. It had to be abandoned, unfortunately, and of course that led to the failure of the airborne drop. We just couldn't get to them. And we're so close, really.
You'd have seen, no doubt, plenty of damage and...
Oh, yes.
All the way up that road, you know, yes, from Eindhoven, yes. There, you'd seen the fighting that had gone to get through.
Yeah. Yes, there's tanks and all sorts littered along the road there. What a horrific moment when we passed one tank that had just been knocked out, and there was... obviously, one of the crew had tried to get out, but the tank had caught fire inside. And when we got him out, there was only half a body there. That was, I think, that's the thing the tank crews used to fear when they were hit with an anti-tank shell. It apparently, I don't know, it used to ricochet around and round the inside of the tank. And I know it's awful, but we're like a mincing machine.
Nijmegen, I think you said you were quite active there.
There was one or two attempts for to blow the bridge. Because naturally, I mean, they knew that all the forces were there waiting to come through. And it was just a narrow gap. There wasn't much to get through, and they had to sort of save that bridge at all costs. That's why we mounted this umbrella and the. There was searchlights round us as well, and they used to, they were constantly on the bridge. I mean, they put the searchlight cover on the bridge, so anything coming through at night would be picked up. We also had with some of our fellows, we had to mount a guard on the river bank, because there was German frogmen active trying to blow the bridge from down below. I think it didn't happen while we were there, but I think they caught a couple of them attempting to demolish the bridge.
And did you get the opportunity to fire on any attempted raid that came in?
We fired the guns, because there was two or three came through, but again, in most cases they were a bit out of our range. But we did. It was very effective. It looked colourful, if nothing else, because, of course, you had the night time, you had the tracer going up as well as the shells, and it was quite fearsome.
Were you occasionally shelled by the Germans?
Not there. We were on the south side of the river, and, of course, there was an awful lot of the activity going on the other side. Where, I mean, the tanks artillery and infantry were constantly moving through Nijmegen to sort of get to the other side, but we had to stay there for the bridge protection, and of course they were the ones that met up with all the opposition from the Tiger tanks. That's where the trouble occurred. We were never actually shelled in Nijmegen itself.
How long were you there?
As far as I can remember, we were there about just over a week. And then we were moved back, actually, into Holland. There was no point, and we couldn't move forward, so we moved back for, retraining and maintenance, gun maintenance and what have you, moved into Weert in Holland.
And this would be an opportunity to get some rest.
Oh, yes, yes. We had, in Wait, we had, I think again, I managed a 48-hour leave. And it was only, it's only a smallish place, but I quite, we quite enjoyed it. There hadn't been any damage done there, so we had decent, we had comfortable billets.
And were they in houses or...?
Houses, yeah. Was it Weird? I think it was Weird where we were in a nunnery. We got billets in a, one of the outbuildings of the nunnery.
What date would this be then? Where are we
well,
now?
Well, you're looking now, I think, at... March.
The drop at Tarnham was September, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. So we're looking now at possibly October. We're getting into October when we went back, because we went back into, as I say, went back into the Wiat in Holland, and then we moved to. We moved from there up to Hechtel, and that's where we were told that we were going to become a rocket firing battery. As my own battery said, we were going to be converted from Bofa guns to what they termed land mattress battery. These were projectiles that from each of the projectors. You had 30 rockets, 5-inch rockets in each projector. And we had the same establishment as for the Bofa guns. That was 6 projectors to the battery, to the troop, and 3 troops to the battery. So we had 18 of these projectors, each with loaded with 35-inch shells. And they were fired in a matter of, I think it was 90 seconds for to get the whole lot off. It was the equivalent, I think, of 15 regiments of 5-inch medium field artillery. Made a terrific. I'm probably a little bit before my time here, because we obviously had to retire and train on these.
And did you know what they were when you told you? You'd have no idea.
We had no idea whatsoever. We didn't know what we were going into. We did 3 weeks training on them, and you had to learn gun laying. I mean, we'd never done gun laying on the Bofors gun, but I mean you had to have weather project. You had to have an OP officer, gunnery officers. Well, they did put a card out of experienced field artillery officers in with us for to do this, but our own officers manned the OPs, and we learned how to lay lines and things like that. I mean, all telephone communications with each one, not the wireless. It was all field telephone.
Was there a reason for that?
Well, possibly because secrecy, because they couldn't, it couldn't be sort of picked up by the Germans. I mean, where if it had been wireless telegraphy, they would have picked it up. And of course, another reason was that we're so close. I mean, each troop was within about 300-400 yards of the other one. So that it was fairly concentrated. You didn't need sort of radio telephone. It was the field telephones were quite adequate and probably more efficient. You could because they were constantly manned while you were firing. But the Canadian Army had these, and they sent instructors as well. They sent the actual gunnery instructors for to take us through it, and they said that we would never learn it in the time, because it was to be for the Rhine Crossing. Well, the Rhine Crossing was due to take place in in March of that
1945,
yes.
Whereabouts was this training held?
It was the training was at Hechtel, which was in Belgium. It's quite near to another town called Wart, which again in Belgium, but close to the river.
So you've told me about the, you know, the shells or whatever they call them.
The rockets, yes.
The rockets. But what did they look like, these rocket firers?
Well,
if you're looking at them, could you describe that to me?
If you can imagine a square box mounted on a wheeled, literally a big wheeled barrow, with the 30 small drain pipes arranged in a row of six at the top and five deep, and all that's literally all the projector was. The rocket was placed in by its fins into each tube. The detonator, the fuse, was set. That each one had to be set individually. It wasn't like the Bofa, it wasn't just on him, but there was a fuse there that had to be set. And at the rear, plugged into the rear of each rocket or each rocket projectile case, was literally a telephone wire. And it was based on a telephone dial system, in as much that when you pressed the button, it went round the dial, and as it clicked at each one, so it fired one of the rockets. It wasn't an elaborate thing by any stretch of imagination.